From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Supreme Court hears arguments today in a case that could have huge implications for voting rights. It's the most significant elections case since 2013, when the court struck down key parts of the Voting Rights Act. Since then, conservatives have expanded their majority on the court, and our voting rights advocates fear this case could pave the way for Republican lawmakers on the state level to make it harder to vote. Let's bring in Emily Bazelon. She's a senior researcher at Yale Law School and staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Hi, Emily.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's break this down a little bit. Arizona's attorney general is defending two laws in his state before the court today. What exactly is at issue here?
So directly at issue are two restrictions on voting in Arizona. One of them says that if you cast your ballot at the wrong precinct, it's going to get thrown out. And the other provision makes it a crime to collect the ballots of other people for delivery unless you are a family member or a caregiver or an election official. So those are the two provisions directly at stake here. And the Democratic Party in Arizona, which is challenging them, says that these provisions are having a disproportionate effect on Latino and especially Native American voters who tend to have less access to polling places because they live in remote areas.
Okay, this case could have implications far beyond Arizona because the larger issue here is a section of the Voting Rights Act that prohibits voting restrictions based on race. What does today's case mean for the Voting Rights Act specifically?
Yeah, so we're talking about Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And that section lets people challenge a restriction on voting if they can show that it abridges the right to vote based on race. So the big question here is, what's the test? How do you win a case like that? And that question, the standard that the Supreme Court could set in this case, that would affect all kinds of restrictions on voting and whether they can be challenged. Things like closing a polling place in a Black or Latino neighborhood, or even just making it harder to vote by mail for everybody. The question is, if those kinds of provisions have a disproportionate impact based on race, what do you have to prove to win the case?
Okay, I mentioned the court back in 2013 struck down key parts of the Voting Rights Act. And this case comes as Republican state lawmakers across the country are proposing new restrictions on voting. Is it possible the justices could issue a ruling narrow enough that it affects just Arizona? Or could this case determine the fate of those future voting restrictions that are in question as well?
Well, the court could issue a decision that's narrow in terms of the kinds of voting restrictions at issue in Arizona. But the court's rulings always have national implications. And what's really at issue here are sort of two forces colliding. So before 2013 and the Supreme Court's last big Voting Rights Act ruling, the country relied on the Department of Justice to have to pre-approve changes to things like closing polling places that might have more of an impact on minorities of voters. The Supreme Court said, no, the Justice Department doesn't get to do that anymore. Now plaintiffs have to use this other part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, to challenge voting restrictions after they go into effect. And so we have this big case about what the test is for those challenges, as more than 200 bills across the country in most of the states are being proposed that would impose new voting restrictions. And so, you know, these are the issues here. What happens to those bills? How can they be challenged in court?
Mm-hmm. Okay, you've been listening to oral arguments. What did you hear today? Any sign of how the justices might rule based on the questions that were asked?
Well, you know, we have this new, stronger conservative majority on the Supreme Court that, like, is just kind of getting started. And it's interesting to watch that dynamic because this is a very partisan battle, this case. It pits the Democratic Party of Arizona against the Republican Party and the state of Arizona. And so I was listening especially to the conservative voices on the court. I did hear some hints of openness to the argument that there should be a pretty substantial right under Section 2 to challenge voting restrictions. I heard hints like that a little bit from Chief Justice John Roberts, and Amy Coney Barrett, who's the newest Supreme Court justice, also had an interesting moment where She said, reducing opportunity is reducing opportunity, even if there are other avenues of voting to voters of color. And so that was an interesting observation. But, you know, we have very little experience of watching how Justice Barrett's comments and oral argument translate into results. So we're going to have to watch.
Yes. I mean, before I let you go, when do you think a ruling might come down?
You know, I think this is a big case, and so it's likely to take a few months. Could even be the end of the term in June, which is when we tend to get the biggest decisions of the year.
Emily Bazelon is a senior research scholar at Yale Law School and staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. As always, thank you.
Thanks so much.
And let's continue this conversation about voting rights with Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Julian, before we dive into the history, I do want to collect your thoughts on today, because we see voting rights in question before the Supreme Court and across the country in many state legislatures. And critics say these are efforts to make it more difficult for some people to vote, minorities in particular. So what do you make of this moment when voting rights appear threatened?
Well, I think the critics are right. We've been moving in the wrong direction from 1965. Rather than strengthening voting rights and trying to make it easier to vote, we've seen efforts at the state level to curtail the ability of people to vote. We had the 2013 Supreme Court decision, which undermined part of the Voting Rights Act. And now we're watching to see if the Supreme Court takes another big bite out of the federal protections that prevent states from restricting the right of Americans to be part of our democracy.
You mentioned two key years there, 2013 and 1965. Let's get into the first one first. 1965 is, of course, when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act on August 6th of that year. And here's a bit of the message that he delivered to the nation on that day.
The wrong is one which no American in his heart can justify. The right is one which no American, true to our principles, can deny.
Now, Julian, that was 1965, 100 years after the end of the Civil War. I mean, why did it take a full century to pass a law aimed at ensuring that Black Americans would have the same right to vote as whites?
Well, the opposition to voting rights in the South was immense. African Americans couldn't register to vote. They faced a barrage of literacy tests, poll taxes, questions about minute parts of the state constitution, and even outright intimidation and violence. And in Congress, a coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans were able to prevent legislation each time it was proposed, using mechanisms like the filibuster to stop growing numbers of senators who wanted to push legislation from succeeding.
You know, those measures that you're describing, the poll taxes, literacy tests, of course, eroded progress that had been made during Reconstruction, when Black Americans had made notable gains at the ballot box during Reconstruction. And so the Voting Rights Act, in a way, was a way of reinforcing rights that, in theory, already existed under the 15th Amendment, right?
That's absolutely true. The Voting Rights Act wasn't granting that right. They were committing the federal government to protecting that right. It came, the legislation in 1965, after it had become painfully clear how far governments were willing to go at the state level to prevent that amendment from being fulfilled.
So let's get specific here. What in particular did the Voting Rights Act do?
Well, one part is what Emily talked about, the part that's under threat right now, in that it forbade state laws that resulted in African Americans not being able to vote. It also had what was called a preclearance provision, which meant that if a government wanted to change how they did the voting and that state had a record of discrimination, they needed the approval of the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice could essentially block that. Those were two of the key provisions. It also prohibited the use of literacy tests and other kinds of restrictions that had been part of that Jim Crow era.
And that preclearance provision was significantly weakened by a Supreme Court ruling in 2013. I think that's the Shelby case that you were referring to earlier. But was the Voting Rights Act in danger even before then?
It was. Journalists and scholars like Ari Berman and Michael Waldman have written pretty good histories of how there was a growing effort within conservative circles since the 1980s to start to push back against the Voting Rights Act and what it had accomplished, and to free up the states to, you know, have more latitude to set their own laws. But it really wasn't until the 2010s that we saw the all-out assault begin. Until then, there had still been Republican support, bipartisan support for the Voting Rights Act from Republicans like Bob Dole, who continued to push the reauthorization of that law. So we're really looking at the last 10 years when we've seen a significant change in the bipartisan support for these measures.
That's Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thanks as always for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Academy Award-winning actor Jared Leto has transformed himself yet again in his latest film, The Little Things, a crime drama where Leto plays appliance delivery man Albert Sparma, a prime suspect in a series of Los Angeles murders in the 1990s. The detectives on the case are played by actors Rami Malek and Denzel Washington. And in this scene, Denzel's character, Joe Deacon, is highly suspicious of Sparma and the possibility that he used his car in his crimes.
I saw the for sale sign.
That was for another car.
Got a lot of miles on it. You a salesman?
No.
How's the trunk space?
Standard.
Mind if I take a look?
Jared Leto has been nominated for a SAG Award for his performance in The Little Things. It's available via streaming on HBO Max, and Jared Leto joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Jared, I've always suspected you're an actor who is highly selective of the roles you play. What drew you to this character and this film?
Well, Denzel Washington was a big draw for me. He's been a hero of mine for a long time. John Lee Hancock wrote a great script, and he's just a terrific director. And then there's Rami Malek, just someone I really think is a terrific talent, and I really enjoyed working with quite a bit. So the three of those guys made it kind of impossible to say no.
Yeah, I can imagine. Once you hear Denzel and Rami's name, you're on board for sure. Yeah. This movie doesn't take on the usual tropes of crime dramas. It's focused on the effects this kind of work has on the detectives who investigate it. Given that shift, what was it like to embody this kind of character who really doesn't show up until, what is it, like 40 minutes into this film?
It was a lot of fun. It was a really transformational, really from head to toe. There were prosthetics involved. I had different color eyes, different teeth, a different way of walking and talking. And I really enjoyed that process of diving in deep and kind of sculpting this character. You know, when you do these kinds of things, you know, for me, it's always an opportunity to see what you're made of. And it's just an absolutely explosive set with Denzel and Rami. It was creatively incredibly exciting.
Yeah, I want to ask you more about working with them. But you said, you know, this transformation is kind of a way for you to see what you're made of. And you do that a lot. I mean, you're known for these physical transformations. Like, you gained something like 70 pounds to play John Lennon's killer in Chapter 27. I always wanted to know, Jared, what's the process once the film is over? How do you come back to yourself, both physically and mentally, after taking yourself so far?
Well, you stop eating ice cream and pizza for breakfast. That helps. It can be a little difficult to just cold turkey walk away from it. So there is a weaning period for me, pretty much with every role that I take on. If there's a physical component, it can be even harder to let go, even if that's an accent or a different way you've trained yourself to speak or walk. Or if you spend a certain time, like in The Little Things, there was a lot of time researching kind of the darker side of humanity. And, you know, at a certain point that can have an effect on your psyche. So I usually find by the end of the film, you're usually grateful to have a bit of a break and get some fresh air. But it does take some time to let go of the process.
I can imagine. Oh, absolutely. I can imagine. Well, let's listen to a bit of a scene where you're interrogated by detectives Jim Baxter and Joe Deacon, who is played by Denzel Washington. He's presenting you with an envelope of crime scene photos. Let's listen.
This is the part where I start feeling like it's a trap.
Open it up, find out.
It's not a pair of mittens.
Take a look. You know you want to.
This pivotal scene, though, was very important for the audience to begin to understand your character. Can you describe for us a little bit more what it was like working together with these guys?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good question. I hadn't done a scene yet. It was actually the first scene that we all did with each other. So there was a lot of tension in the air. There was a lot of energy, a lot of excitement. And we didn't rehearse the scene at all. We didn't even do a camera rehearsal, really. They set the cameras up and we just went to work. And I remember after the first take, I thought that, wow, I just really blew it. This isn't working. This is terrible. I've ruined the movie. And my God, I have to help them find a new person for the part. Because I just did the scene and there was just this deafening silence afterwards and everybody kind of just scattered and left the room. What I didn't know, and I found out later, was that they ran back to the monitor to watch the scene and they were kind of just all buzzing with excitement because I think everyone was feeling like something was actually working and working really well. Little did I know, I thought both myself and the scene were a disaster, and I was ready to take the blame fully.
I mean, your eyes were really doing the work in that scene, Jared. I want to say, your eyes looking at those pictures, that was what was so, I'm sure they were all running back to the screen to see, and they got it. Yeah. I mean, acting in your eyes for sure.
It's interesting because my eyes were brown in that film, and Albert Sparma, I always felt he was the type of person that just didn't understand personal space or boundaries. So, you know, he would look at someone or stare at someone too long, or maybe he would talk a little too slowly, or he would maybe just, you know, walk a little too closely to someone. And in that scene, it was especially intense because he's toying with the detectives. He's interviewing them as much as they're interrogating him. Whether or not even the things that he's saying are true, is he just trying to get a rise out of the other people? Is he really excited looking at those photos? I don't know. Maybe he's not. Maybe he's just enjoying the cat and mouse game and playing chess with these guys who he feels like, you know, are a good match for him.
You've got another upcoming film where you appear as the Joker in Zack Snyder's new version of Justice League. What can fans expect from this latest interpretation of the character?
Well, as far as working with Zack Snyder, he's just, I really loved the experience of working with him. He's just a terrific director, incredibly passionate, really decisive, you know, a real actor's director, a real artist. The rest of it, I think you're going to have to ask him. It's kind of like Fight Club, you know, that the first rule is the most important rule. So I know he has lots of secrets and surprises planned. So I'll be careful not to spoil them, but it was a pleasure to work with Zach. He's an amazing guy.
Oh, well, that definitely is a tease to definitely make certain that we all check it out. I have one last question for you before you go. I'm sitting here looking at a picture of you as I'm talking to you. When are you coming out with your beauty and health line? Because how are you forever young? I can't even believe that you still look like you looked 20 years ago.
I have to thank my mom, who's in the other room right now, for that. And good, clean, healthy living.
Jared Leto stars in the new film, The Little Things, which is available via streaming on HBO Max. Jared, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Many seniors are getting their first and second doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, but hundreds of thousands of others have died before they could be inoculated. And now their families are seeing others get vaccinated at the same time that they're dealing with painful losses. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville reports.
It was sunshine and blue skies the day Mary Rich and her husband drove from their rural home in Watertown, Tennessee, to get the COVID-19 vaccine. A local church has become the primary vaccination site in their county. Rich called to get on the waiting list and thought it would take weeks.
And then today they called and said, can you come in today at 2:30 that we can do your vaccination today? And I said, well, you're not kidding. We can. We'll be there.
But the joy of the occasion was tempered by a death in the family so fresh it was still hard to accept. Rich's sister, who lives about an hour away, had just died of COVID only 2 days before.
We were very close. Very close. Life won't ever be the same.
Rich says her 83-year-old sister, Barbara Gill, was so careful not to catch COVID, she barely got out of the house.
I haven't seen my sister in months because of this.
But then she fractured her back, requiring a stay in a rehab hospital. That's where Rich says she must have gotten sick. Her condition deteriorated, and when she wasn't getting better, the family decided Gill wouldn't have wanted to be put on a ventilator. She was unconscious when they said their goodbyes remotely.
I had them go take the phone and put it up to her ear, because they say that hearings last to go. People in the family, we had them hold the phone to her ear, and so we one at a time, we talked to her and told her we loved her.
Stepchildren, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. Barbara Gill is even survived by one great-great-grandchild. She worked as a legal secretary after college, then at her old high school as a bookkeeper. She was also a seamstress and generally had a knack for crafts. Up until her recent health challenges, she was making mementos for a local funeral home owned by relatives. She printed the deceased person's obituary on a memorial bookmark for everyone to take home. Rich says as they planned Gill's funeral, they wondered who would make the bookmarks for her.
Yeah, it didn't have to be. That was the thing. It didn't have to be, because she was not by any means to the place where she was going to die anywhere. It was the COVID that killed her.
COVID's a nasty disease, Rich says, so she's happy to have the vaccine so her family can avoid enduring the same grief again. For Here and Now, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
A new development in the ongoing effort to reunite some 500 migrant children who were separated from their families under the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy at the U.S.-Mexico border. The Biden administration will now allow families who were separated the option of being reunited here in the United States. Here's Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas yesterday stressing the need to undo the previous administration's work.
We will dig out of the cruelty of the past administration, and we will rebuild our nation's asylum system and all of our humanitarian programs, of which we have been historically so proud.
Jacob Soboroff is an NBC and MSNBC correspondent and author of Separated, Inside an American Tragedy. And he's been following this story and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Jacob.
Good to be back with you, Tanya. Thanks.
Yes. So the most significant part of this effort is that it allows families to be reunited here on U.S. soil. Why is this especially important?
Well, for the very reason that the families left their home country and came to seek asylum in the United States in the first place. Many of them were fleeing danger, persecution, starvation, malnutrition, acute food insecurity. The list goes on and on. And when they made it to the United States of America, the place that represented safety and security and asylum, they were tortured, in the words of Physicians for Human Rights. They were put through government-sanctioned child abuse, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. It was one of the greatest human rights catastrophes of my lifetime, in the words of an official who had worked on the reunifications, as he told me directly. And so this is the recourse that all of the advocates and the lawyers that have been working with these families now for over 3 years have been seeking. And it's welcome news. It's not reunification yet, but it's a step in that direction.
Let's get to the particulars. How will these reunification efforts actually work? How will families know about these policy changes?
Literally door-to-door knocking in Central America. There's a steering committee in the federal lawsuit that won the reunification of the families, Miss L versus ICE, and they're going door-to-door. Justice in Motion, the Women's Refugee Commission, Kids in Need of Defense. This is a group that has been involved in this process for quite some time. But up until this point, the reason that there were 611 parents of children who had been separated, who had yet not been contacted, that number is now 499 after 112 of them have been found over the course of the last months. The reason it's been taking so long is because of a lack of a willingness from the federal government under the Trump administration to participate in this process. And the Biden administration has now changed that.
Okay, I have just under a minute with you, but the ACLU and groups like Physicians for Human Rights have applauded these changes, but they're also calling on actors involved in these separations to be held accountable. How would that happen?
I think it's the most critical remaining unanswered question about the family separation tragedy. I really think that that's, you know, what it must be called. You know, the president said during the final presidential debate he believed this was criminal. He said he was going to launch a thorough investigation of the Justice Department. There's plenty of evidence of who was responsible for this policy, whether it was Jeff Sessions, Stephen Miller, Gene Hamilton, Kirsten Nielsen. That list goes on and on as well. It's a matter of whether or not they want to pursue an investigation like the president said that they would.
Jacob, we'll have to have you on again. Jacob Sabaroff is NBC's correspondent and author of Separated Inside, an American Tragedy. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
The recent airstrikes in Syria are a reminder of the scope of military reach around the world. And there's new research that shows the U.S. conducted counterterrorism operations in 85 countries from 2018 through 2020. The data comes from the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute. Researcher Stephanie Savelle is co-director of the project and joins us. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much.
So I think most Americans know that we're carrying out military operations in countries like Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq, but that's just three. And you say the American military has been carrying out counterterrorism operations in more than 80 other countries. So give us some other examples of where these operations are happening.
So, for example, in Kenya in 2020, there was a Al-Shabaab raid on an airfield in Manda Bay. That's a military base that's important for U.S. counterterrorism in Somalia. And that raid killed one service member and two contractors. And in the process, U.S. service members and contractors were engaging in direct firefight with those militant groups. Another example is Nigeria. Not too long ago, also in 2020, there was a special forces that conducted a hostage rescue mission. It killed at least six of the captors. And the reason we were so quick to step in that case was that the U.S. was worried that the group that kidnapped this hostage was going to sell the hostage to either Al-Qaeda, the affiliate of Al-Qaeda, or ISIS in the area. Somalia, Mali, Yemen, we have examples of eight different countries in which U.S. troops engaged in that kind of on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground combat in the past few years.
I see. So eight where Americans are involved in combat, and then seven other countries, according to your data, where we were carrying out air or drone strikes. And I'm wondering if you saw a trend there. I mean, do you see a heavier reliance in recent years on drone strikes and missile strikes rather than ground troops?
Oh, absolutely. The ground troops are more rare and certainly more rare to find a record of them. We were combing through kind of public records, including investigative journalism. There was you know, definitely an uptick in air and drone strikes, especially during the Trump administration. And places like Somalia, there are huge increase in numbers of drone strikes. But also we're seeing air and drone strikes in, you know, of course, Afghanistan and Iraq, Libya, Pakistan, Syria, Yemen. So seven countries we documented in all in the past 3 years where we've been conducting direct air and drone strikes ourselves.
This sounds like very comprehensive research, Stephanie, but as you say that you're relying on public records and some journalism in some cases, is it also possible that there were some operations that we still don't know about?
Absolutely. We were actually very conservative in the data points that we selected for this map. So we say at least 85 countries, and it is very likely that there were points that we didn't capture, because a lot of this, you know, the U.S. government is not transparent about a lot of this. There's not like you can go to a website and find out, you know, where have we undertaken counterterror operations? I think of it as, you know, kind of an octopus, like the head of the counterterror operations are in the Middle East. And then there's kind of dozens of tentacles stretching all across the globe from Mali to the Philippines, all these places where we're undertaking operations that the American public really just, you know, doesn't usually find out about.
And just so that we're clear on your definition of counterterror operations, what else are you counting besides combat and airstrikes?
So those are the places where we've, you know, those are the most kind of intense actions that we documented on the map. Where the numbers come in are in the other categories. We documented 41 countries in which the U.S. conducted military exercises in the name of counterterrorism. So this is when the U.S. military conducts a training exercises with a foreign military that's either intended to deter militants or prepare that military, that foreign military, for a counterterror operation. That was 41 countries, and then 79 in which we documented the U.S. carrying out training and assistance in counterterrorism. And this is carried out not just by the Department of Defense, but also the Department of State, Justice, Homeland Security. So lots of civilian agencies are involved in these kind of counterterrorism training and assistance. And that ranges, there's a huge range, anything from, you know, training police forces to better operate in counterterror operations to installing a border patrol system that's connected to a global database of terrorists.
You know, the sprawl that you're describing, Stephanie, is really striking, particularly in contrast to that of China, because we often hear that China is the biggest threat to the United States, and yet China's military reach doesn't even come close to our own. In fact, China has just one overseas military base. It's in Africa. So what does that tell you?
So China's going at things from a really different tactic. It's cutting economic deals. It's building roads and infrastructure. It's building influence in different ways. The U.S. is relying on this very old-fashioned approach of a kind of empire-like physical presence. We hear a lot about the Pentagon shifting its strategic focus to competition with Russia and China rather than counterterrorism. But if you look at the physical kind of footprint of where these actions are taking place all around the world, you see that there's yet to be a corresponding drawdown of the counterterror apparatus.
You know, Stephanie, this year we're going to mark the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and in that time, the U.S. launched what is known as the War on Terror. Can you give us a sense of the human cost that we've experienced in the last couple of decades?
Costs of War Project research has shown that we've lost more than 800,000 lives in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, and Yemen over the course of these years. Those are some of the major hotspots. And those are just the direct loss through bombs and bullets. We've lost countless more through the indirect reverberating effects, things like displacement, loss of livelihood, loss of infrastructure, the growth, you know, the increase of diseases. So we're really talking about millions of people who have died as a result of these wars.
And that's the blood half of the blood and treasure phrase that we hear so often attached to war. So help us also understand the treasure half of that. It's really hard to get around the amount of money that's been spent on the war on terror. What did you find?
It's such a huge number. We can't even grasp it. $6.4 trillion since 2001. That is, you know, it's including things like our commitment to care for veterans of the post-9/11 wars. It's including the interest that we're spending on borrowing for these wars. These are really credit card wars. We've paid for them largely through borrowing. So this $6.4 trillion, and now it's even greater. Probably the next time we come out with an estimate, it's going to be closer to seven, is just a huge amount of taxpayer money, so much that it's affecting every other budget item in this country. So if you think about the spending that we are able to do on things like the pandemic and anything else, housing, you name it, it's all being squeezed by the amount of money that we spend on the military and on these post-9/11 wars.
And so your research documents foreign activities through the end of 2020. And I'm mindful that 6 days into 2021, we had an insurrection at our own Capitol building, which I think really underscored the threat posed by domestic extremists instead of foreign terrorists. So I'm curious whether you think that might actually be the biggest threat we face.
Absolutely. We have to. I think what this research shows is that we need to kind of fundamentally rethink, are these post-9/11 wars and the vast costs in blood and treasure that are coming with them, are they meeting our goals of protecting Americans, of protecting civilians around the world? And research really points to the fact that treating terrorism as a problem that can be solved by war is not an effective way of going about it. It's been completely counterproductive by some measures. There are more terrorist groups than there were before 9/11. There are more recruits to those groups in more parts of the world. So we really just need to ask those big questions and think about new ways of understanding what safety really means for the U.S.
Stephanie Savelle is co-director of the Costs of War Project at Brown University's Watson Institute. There's a link to her research at hereandnow.org. Stephanie, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Senate is now considering legislation that would ban all forms of discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. The Equality Act would also protect senior citizens in the LGBTQ community. A number of surveys finds older people tend to go back into the closet as they enter their senior years. That's largely because they're more likely to face discrimination in healthcare, assisted living, and hospice facilities. From Colorado Public Radio, Claire Cleveland has the story.
Esther Lucero met the love of her life, Kathy, back in 1980. We're not using Kathy's last name for privacy reasons. They worked together in Denver. At first, they were just friends.
There was nothing at the beginning, but she told me, she says, the first day I met you, I said, I'm going to spend the rest of my life with that girl. So there you go.
They started dating a few years later. Then they moved in together and bought a house. In 2015, they got married. A couple years later, Lucero and Kathy both got colds. Lucero got better, but Kathy was diagnosed with a rare form of leukemia. Lucero told healthcare staff that Kathy was her wife, despite her partner's warning.
Kathy's the one that told me, she says, don't tell the nurses that we're married, okay? And I said, why? And she says, because they're treating you differently. And they're treating me differently. I said, okay.
Lucero says some staff responded well, but others did seem off-put. She thought they were treated differently at times because they were gay. One nurse seemed to avoid Kathy's room, and Lucero says sometimes others would wait for her to leave before telling Kathy details about her condition.
And to me, it was like, hey, I'm married to her, you know, and it just hurt. I don't even know how to say it. I know I cried that night.
6 months after her diagnosis, Kathy died. Lucero was devastated. While together, she and Kathy had kept their relationship private from a lot of family, colleagues, and neighbors. Carrie Kandrian says that's common. She's a professor and researcher at the University of Colorado and works with LGBTQ seniors. She says many feel isolated.
Then they follow up with, but I haven't been able to tell anyone, or my family never knew. And I just get chills when I say that, because I think for people who don't identify as LGBT, I think it's so easy to forget just the work that hiding requires.
Kandrian says one statistic haunts her. A public health study from Columbia University found that LGBTQ people who live in communities with high rates of discrimination can lose 12 years of life expectancy. Early on in her career, Kandrian shadowed a hospice worker at an in-home consult. She noticed how the forms were tailored toward heterosexual and cisgendered people, asking questions like, "Are you married?" rather than, "Do you have a partner?"
As an LGBT person, you face a really, it's a heck of a choice. You know, do you stay silent and come out and risk not having your partner be involved, risk not having, you know, the person who shares half your memories, who can advocate for you, or do you stay quiet?
Kandrian says most hospice and assisted living facilities don't ask patients about their sexual orientation and gender identity, so there's not much data on LGBTQ seniors, and it's hard to tell how widespread these problems are.
Which means we're not really able to ever develop interventions that are specifically tailored for this population.
One way to start, Kandrian says, is by giving people a new vocabulary. And that can happen through conversations, like the ones she's leading at six Denver-area facilities run by the nonprofit Christian Living Communities. There, she's helping to train staff to be more aware of LGBTQ seniors and provide a safe space for them to be more open. Stormy Faust-Maley works at one of those facilities.
The vast majority of people who are LGBTQ who look for senior living go back into the closet in order to feel that they won't be discriminated against or that they'll be accepted by their neighbors.
She started an LGBT plus friends group at the facility and was surprised by which residents showed up. One man she thought was there to be disruptive was instead in need of the group. Others she didn't even know were gay, but she thought she was close with them. They're using grant money to create an educational video to give staff more LGBTQ competency training. Faust-Maley says she hopes this leads to more of these seniors getting proper care and equal treatment.
If we can help make this process easier for other people or inspire other people to do this work, then, I mean, it's a lofty goal, but, you know, that would be amazing.
Back at her condo, Esther Lucero says she didn't have many people to grieve with after her wife, Kathy, passed. So instead, she wrote letters to Kathy and talked to a therapist. But eventually, Lucero finally started to meet with LGBTQ groups, and that helped her open up.
This is who I am. If I say I'm not, it's like Kathy never existed to some extent. She did exist. And to me, coming out was a way of saying, look, she was my wife, and I did love this person very much. She was everything to me.
Lucero says she hopes that sharing her story will help encourage other LGBTQ seniors to be more open, too, whether it's with family or at the hospital. For Here and Now, I'm Claire Cleveland.
And this afternoon on All Things Considered, a closer look at Bitcoin. The cryptocurrency has soared over the last year, and investors have piled in for fear of missing out. But skeptics are worried the bubble will eventually burst. That story today on ATC. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now.